told this obnoxious noise is stopping at 9, so hopefully we are done with the obnoxious noise, at least coming from that source. Any preliminary issues or questions? Okay, I hope we finished with chapter 7 yesterday. And again, the issues in chapter 7 are relatively straightforward in these three different categories, determining what the limitation period is, determining when that commences, and finally determining if there's some reason to put the period on hold. We'll come back to this, as I've said before, in chapter 10, where the Washington medical malpractice statute is an example of kind of statutory reform, includes a provision for modifying the statute of limitations rules as they apply to medical malpractice. Good. Thank you. So, with the end of Chapter 7, we have finished Part 2. Did they say test concluded? Oh. With the end of Chapter 7, we finished Part 2, and again, Part 2 was all about sort of looking at the world from the defendant's standpoint, at least with respect to certain kinds of affirmative defenses. As we start Part 3, I want to give you sort of an overview of what the common theme is to all these chapters, and the common theme is contained in this sort of introductory section, and it has to do with the general problems of sort of regime dominance. That's too abstract a word there. The word paradigm is overused, but to the extent that large systems are often governed by sort of key concepts, you can have the behavior in certain areas explicable only by reference not to some specific detail, but rather to some larger... there's a demon in your... that's all right. Probably take the battery out. Again, it's useful to kind of look at the big question here. And I think the big question that's going on in Part 3 is the relationship between the tort regime on the one hand and the regime of contract on the other. I think support might be too strong a word. Yeah. Okay. So it would be easier to do this if you'd been spending as much time studying contract law as studying tort law. One of the benefits of taking this class along with other classes is that you get sort of multiplicity of it's sort of like I guess it's the Seven Samurai movie where you see all these different. You know, you see the same event from a variety of different perspectives. Someone once pointed out that the sort of reigning paradigm in American law or English law was the idea of contract. That at the root of most things is sort of Lockean notion that at the root of government lies agreement. You know, that people, it's the consent of the governed. That's sort of the, at the heart of things is sort of an agreement or consent. With it, all things are possible. Without it, nothing is possible. At the root of the Soviet Union, on the other hand, the reigning concept was criminal law. Essentially, everything's about coercion, and it's who coerces whom. Now, tort law has a different kind of perspective, which is not exactly contract, it's not exactly criminal law. As we'll see, at the heart of tort law is the notion of protecting people from harm. At the root of contract is the idea we want to encourage people to make the best deals they can for themselves, and we want to have a regime that enforces contracts so that people get the benefit of the deals they have made. Now, there's a certain sort of regime collision here, because there are times, and I would say this reflects a certain ambivalence in our own personalities, there are times when we want to be free to make our own choices. We don't want to be constrained by somebody else's idea of what's good for us. And then there are times when we do want to be protected from exploitation. So as the parent of teenagers or recently teenaged children, it's very fresh in my mind, the sort of alternating perception, which is give me the keys to the car, which is both let me do my own thing, but oh, by the way, you know, did you remember to fill it up with gas? Child to parent, you know, did you remember to fill it up with gas? As on the one hand, I want to be free to make my own choices, but on the other hand, I want to be protected from having to be responsible for all sorts of things. So, as Gilmore points out, and it reminds me how what an old geezer I am, that when I was going to law school, this was hot off the press, and now it's almost 30 years old. Gilmore's idea was, in effect, there is this ongoing sort of cyclical change between the seeing the world as essentially one gigantic contract versus seeing the world as one gigantic system of protection of people from having harm done to them. So, and Gilmore has this sort of grand historical sweep here to say it does go in cycles, and at the risk of drawing too strained an analogy, to some extent it reflects a political division. That is, the world of contract is essentially a Republican world in which people pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And the democratic world, the world of tort is a democratic world in which people are protected from, or the weak are protected from the people who do them harm. And we are sort of ambivalent as a country about which of these two things we prefer. We go in cycles from thinking, you know, we're sick of all this overbearing government, we want to get government off the backs of people. And then we think, oh, we don't want another Enron. We don't want another, system of exploitation. So as you observe what's going on in tort law, you will see this intermixture on the one hand of saying we like the ability of people to make their own deals, and we want to honor that. We want to enforce the deals people have made. At the same time, we're thinking to ourselves, Yeah, but lots of times people don't really know what they're getting in for, or it's in society's interest to prevent people from making deals that are exploitive. And different people have different ideas about what's exploitive and what's, you know, should we let people take their clothes off for money? You know, is that something that's, it's a free country, everybody ought to be able to do that? Or is that a form of exploitation that we say, no, that's wrong? And if people think they're getting a good deal out of that, they're just fooling themselves, or, you know, there's some reason why we ought to prevent that. Should people be able to inject themselves with various hallucinogenic or, you know, mind-altering substances? Should they be able to smoke cigarettes if they want to? Should people be able, you know, all sorts of different things where some people would say, hey, it's a free country, and other people would say, no, this is something where it's our duty as a society to keep people from doing that. So again, I would say, as you look over the sort of broad landscape, as you look at it sort of in historical perspective, we are conflicted. Some of you may personally be completely consistent and non-conflicted. You're completely a contractarian and have no interest in being protected or in protecting anybody else. Some of you may be completely in the protection mode, in which you think people's, the idea of personal freedom is sort of illusory, and what we really need is a healthy society in which people make good choices, in which the strong protect the weak. And you have, you know, at every point you will sacrifice the contract interest to the tort interest. But I suspect most of you are in that conflicted middle ground where you say, well, sometimes I think people ought to be able to make their own choices, and at other times I think, no, the government should step in and essentially protect people from getting ripped off. And so we'll sort of watch the law in these succeeding chapters, particularly tort law, as it struggles with these areas in which plaintiff and defendant are not strangers who meet in an intersection for the first time because their cars collide. We're talking about people who already have some kind of a relationship. It's a visitor to land and the owner to land who are now in a dispute over an injury that occurred on that land. Or it's someone who bought a product or someone who's using a product who gets hurt by that product and they sue the person who sold it. It's a patient of a healthcare provider. Or it's someone who's relying on someone else for counseling or for some other kind of thing. And again, we have to figure out what's the effect of that relationship on the definition of the duty that is owed by the defendant to the plaintiff. The standard the plaintiff has to meet in order to claim compensation. Again, this will, in many cases, seem like a recapitulation of Chapter 1. We're going back over the question, when should defendants be held liable? But as we'll see, starting sort of with this kind of presumption of a standard of reasonable care, what happens is we say, well, because of the relationship here, we're going to tweak that standard. We're going to make it a little bit different, or maybe we won't, but it, as I say, the relationship affects how we describe what it is the plaintiff can reasonably expect of the defendant. So, our first chapter in this part is Chapter 8, Premises Liability, which has to do with, obviously, landowners and visitors to land. Obviously, the first case deals with presents, in effect, the traditional approach to this question, along with a critique of that standard. Actually, the first two cases, Gounce as well as Roland, present these two, present the traditional standard criticisms of it. So can somebody tell us about Younce versus Ferguson? suitably disciplined, I take it, yes. Going once, going yowns, going twice. You thought there was a... Oh, there we are, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Traditional American ritual here.
Yeah. Plaintiff was at a tennis party, became intoxicated, and was hit by a car driven by Tamaris Ferguson, who was also at the party.
Okay.
So apparently the parents were uninformed. And they came down with Tiffany Temples and Chris Berger.
Right. When life hands you lemons, you make lemonade, right? Okay.
Right.
Your kids are throwing a kegger, so you bring cooking utensils. Sure, why not?
Okay, so the trial court ordered Ferguson to pay $59,500 in damages.
Okay.
And Deontay also sued Trump for negligent tort-based statutory violation of the Amendment.
Okay.
But it was dismissed, and the plaintiff appealed the prosecution.
Okay, so there's the claim of the injured person against the woman who was driving the car, but there's also a claim against the owner of the land. And once she files the suit against the landowner, it becomes a premises liability case. And how does premises liability work?
Well,
okay, so we now divide the world into these, we divide visitors to land into this, these three statuses. And you can see why people would think this is a relic of the days when there were, there still is, it's not a relic anymore. There's the first class cabin, those passengers seated in rows 1 through 4. And then there are the rest of us who sit in coach. So there are different kinds of people, and some people get free drinks and some people don't. Okay, so we've divided visitors to land into these different kinds of status, and based on that status, they get different kinds of service, in effect. And what are these three... Again, we want to know what the status is. We want to know how we identify them. And then we want to know what kind of care they're entitled to.
Okay,
at the top of the, seated in rows 1 through 4 are invitees. Okay, the next status down is a licensee. And at the very bottom is trespasser. Okay, let's talk about how we identify these folks. An invitee is identified in what? By what indicia? What makes somebody an invitee? So I invite people to dinner. No, that doesn't work. But what is it that makes somebody an invitee? Mr. Trujillo? Yes, that's the distinction here, is that we have a business as opposed to a social kind of relationship. And for that reason, the name is potentially confusing, because as you think about it, you say, well, inviting somebody who's invited, and I may invite my social guests with great enthusiasm and so forth, but they don't become invitees for legal purposes unless the visit is pursuant to the owner's business purpose. suppose, for example, I invited all of you for an end of the summer barbecue in my backyard. What would your status be on my property? What do you think?
Are you going to try to ruin yourself? I mean, to do something or anything like that?
The question would be, what is my purpose? That is, and we would start looking for indicia of my purpose. Did I send the bill for the food to the dean, saying that I'm, you know, building up goodwill? This money you're spending for the Costco hot dogs and so forth is going to repay itself later by alumni contributions. That would be a very clear indication of business purpose. Am I up for tenure? Do I have a harassment claim pending against me and I'm desperately seeking allies? What's my purpose? Or do I have none of the above? I just, you know, enjoy your company and I want you to be there, and it's very clear this has nothing to do with business. Again, part of the difficulty in applying this whole thing is figuring out what is the owner's purpose in this particular business, or in this particular visit. If I'm a stockbroker or a real estate a broker, or I'm a lawyer and I invite people to my house for a social occasion, but these are people that might be clients of mine or might know of other people looking for lawyers or real estate brokers or investment brokers, and again, I deducted from my, you know, on previous occasions, I've deducted events like this from my income taxes, reported it on Schedule C as a business expense. Well, that's a pretty clear indication of what his purpose is. Okay? Now, there's another way you can become an invitee. There's another kind of invitee. Public invitee. Why do we have a separate category for public invitees? What's the distinguishing characteristic of a public invitee? Yeah. I'm sorry, Ms. Agajewski, go ahead.
I have it here. Invite interns.
Okay. And what I would say, the easiest way to remember this is public invitees are to nonprofit or governmental property the same way that business visitors are to Nordstrom or Safeway or a business. That is, if you're Safeway or Nordstrom, people visit your property and you make money out of that. If you're a nonprofit or governmental agency, you get continued funding because you serve the public, though you don't necessarily charge them for a particular visit. So City Hall is open to the public. Gonzaga University has lectures for the public. The public can come there free, but Gonzaga operates its facilities and, in a sense, makes money, gets donations and other things through these visits in the same way that Safeway makes money if you come to their store and buy stuff. So again, public invitees, the category there is nonprofit or governmental, whereas a business invitee is somebody who's there pursuant to the owner's business purpose. Again, there may be subtle differences, but the general concept is there. Okay, licensees. How do we identify them? Okay. They may be invited in the sense, I may send you an engraved invitation to come to my house for dinner, but we speak of this as bare permission to distinguish it from a business purpose. And again, included in this would be social guests. Now, again, it is possible to imagine for a social occasion some sort of business purpose, but in the absence of a business purpose, a social guest is merely a licensee. The bottom of the scale here, how do we know a trespasser? Not only uninvited, but as distinguished from a licensee. What's the difference between a licensee and a trespasser? Yes, there's no permission. So whereas the licensee has bare permission, that is, lacking a business purpose, at least they have permission, the trespasser has none. This doesn't necessarily mean the trespasser is a bad person or violating the law. They may be innocently trespassing. So I may get an invitation to somebody's wedding, which is out in the country in a meadow on somebody's 40 acres that they own out there. And I'm told to take a left off the highway, and then there's a dirt road that's the second, and then there's a mailbox in the second driveway. And I get the wrong dirt road, and I wind up on somebody else's property, not because I want to be trespassing, but I thought that's what the direction said. I'm a trespasser. I don't have the owner's permission to be there. Okay, now let's talk about the duty of care that corresponds to each of these classifications. So again, the concept here is, depending upon where you are in this chart, you can expect more or less care. What's the care that an invitee can expect? Yeah, it's our old friend, the negligence standard. If the whole world were composed of invitees, we wouldn't have a Chapter 8. Because it would just be, it would look just completely normal. So, of course, the owner owes a duty of reasonable care. That's what we're used to. It turns out that if you're not an invitee, you live in a different world. So, if I accept an invitation as a social guest to go to somebody's house, what can I expect of the owner there? They owe unreasonable care. Okay, that's the one they talk about in the Hacienda restaurant case. But there's actually a better way to say that. I can't remember where it's said here someplace. Maybe it's just I've said it, but the standard that you owe to a licensee is, what's that? Yes, it's a duty to warn of perils known, to warn of hidden perils known to the owner. This is not a duty to do something, it's a duty to match information levels. So long as my guest has the benefit of the same information that the owner does, the owner has met the duty to a licensee. If you come to my house and go to use the restroom, and I say, and you walk in and there's a wooden spoon hanging next to the light switch, so that you can turn it on and off without getting shocked. So long as I have warned you, that's the way to turn the light on and off, I've fulfilled the duty that I owe to you as a social guest. If I say on your way out, you know, stay on the right side of the steps, the third step down is you know, missing or about to fall off, don't lean on the railing, I fulfilled my duty. Now, notice the difference between that and the duty of reasonable care. A person exercising reasonable care will, first of all, make periodic inspections of things. So if you're Nordstrom or Safeway, you not only repair the things you know about, but you periodically go around and kick the tires and check to see that things are reasonably safe. Whereas the owner, vis-a-vis a social guest, only has a duty to warn of things they already know about, and then they have no duty to repair them. Even though a reasonable person would spend the $50 to get an electrician to actually, or, you know, would actually just go down and turn the circuit breaker off and buy the $5 switch from the hardware store and unscrew the old one, put the new one back in. But I don't have to do that. The motto of the law with respect to licensees is mi casa y su casa. You know, my house is your house. You take it as you find it. And the law allows the owner to get away with that. It wouldn't allow Nordstrom or Safeway to get away with that. It wouldn't allow Gonzaga University to hang a little sign that says, you know, don't trip over the hole in the carpet here. It would say, what would a reasonable person do? If a reasonable person would replace that section of the carpet so it's not a hazard, that's what would be expected. Let's finally look at the duty that we owe to a trespasser. What's the duty to a trespasser? You can say there's no duty. You can also simply phrase it as essentially don't shoot. That is, you don't have any duty affirmatively to protect them, but you have a duty not to go after them. You can't intentionally try to inflict harm on them. But no matter how hidden the peril, no matter how much the owner knows about it, you remember going back, now we're finally doing the body of law that covered the turntable case and the sulfuric acid case. Everybody started the sulfuric acid case with the idea, if the decedents in this case had been adults, there would be no case. An adult trespasser can't expect anything by way of warning or other sorts of protection from the harm. If a trespasser encounters some deadly harm on the defendant's land, so long as the defendant hasn't set it up to try to be inflict harm, if it's simply a dangerous condition there, adult trespassers can't expect anything. So again, remember that if I'm innocently trespassing on somebody's farmland and I don't realize that they've got, you know, some terrible, there's an electric line that's through various kinds of earth movement and, you know, frost heave and so forth, this electrical conduit that was buried in the ground is now very close to the surface, and I'm wandering around looking for where this wedding reception is, and I step on that thing and get electrocuted. If I'm a trespasser, and the most I can say about the defendant is the defendant didn't protect me from this peril, then the courts would say, well, so what? Trespassers can't expect any duty of protection from the owner. Okay, so here's the traditional way that the law categorized. It didn't say all animals are equal. Well, maybe it did, but it quickly said, but some animals are more equal than others. Some people get a higher level of care than others. And, of course, the plaintiff in this case says, how bizarre, how medieval, how inconsistent with a society in which all persons are entitled to equal protection, equal dignity. Now, let's first of all see what happens when we apply these categories to our facts in this case. On what basis might the plaintiff have argued that she was an invitee? How could she say she was even a business invitee? I paid good money for this cater. And of course, if this were the Junior Achievement Project or the host involved, but it wasn't. And the court looks at this and says, yeah, she paid money, but this is no different from you're getting an invitation. Hey, why don't you come over and watch the end of the Tour de France? What can I bring? Oh, bring some chips if you got them. I got some dip and some beer and so forth, but if you got some chips, that'd be great. Well, you can hardly say I'm a business visitor now because you contribute to the supply. That was essentially the idea. You chip in $4 to pay for the cost of the beer, but this was not a business venture. Again, it's a question of fact. If somebody came to my house and got injured by a condition of the land, and they said DeWolf's invitation was pursuant to some business purpose, you'd have to figure out, okay, exactly what was the purpose here, and there might be evidence relevant to that question. Hello.
Would the plaintiff want to use the fact that they bought a lot of alcohol as for proving that they had like an inventory to sell, kind of?
Well, again, if they bought a lot of beer with the idea they were going to make a profit, that would be one thing. But you know, this was a social occasion, albeit a poorly thought out one. But as distinguished from something where they were in the business, keggers are us, kind of a deal. So again, it's not to say it's a crazy idea. It's simply saying on these facts, it belongs more in this category than it belongs in that category. Yeah.
So going back to licensing, what exactly is a hidden danger or hidden peril? I mean, is there any argument?
I invite you to my house on December 15th. On December 15th, my driveway is snowy. It's snowed, it's melted, it froze, it thawed. There's a little skiff of snow covering my driveway. I don't tell you that underneath that skiff of snow is ice. But I live a little bit, hypothetically, I live on the South Hill, where snow stays a little longer. It's a few degrees cooler up there than it is down here, particularly close to the river. Is it a hidden peril that underneath the snow is ice that I have to warn you about? Or does a person living in Spokane exercise common sense to realize that when it snows, snow melts, snow freezes, water freezes, etc.? I don't know whether that's a hidden peril. Did I have a duty to warn you about that because it was hidden? Now, again, all these are sort of factual questions. Does water drip off the side of the roof? So it actually, the water that froze that's underneath that layer of snow actually came from the roof, where it melted off the roof, dripped down onto my driveway, and then flowed down the driveway to form this very slick ice underneath the snow. Again, that might be a hidden peril that a person simply walking around, the other parts just have snow or bare ground. This one had, this hidden peril. So again, the frustrating thing about premises liability cases is that they're very fact-driven. Depending upon the difference in my state of mind between a purely social visit and a visit in which I'm trying to attract clients, or I'm trying to line up some kind of business opportunity, that's a judgment call. What's a hidden peril? If it's quite clear that the third step is cracked, You know, I got wooden steps leading up to my front door, and the third one is clearly, you know, it's broken. Is that a hidden peril, or is it one where you would say, no, that's a reasonable person would see that's not the place to walk up the stairs? So, again, a jury would have to say, is this hidden or is it not? But again, the standard is that the visitor can only expect to be warned of hidden perils as opposed to things like, if it's been 20 degrees all day, the roads are likely, paths are likely to be frozen. Yeah?
Are service people, the licensees, the delivery boy, the guy brings the hot water tank?
Well, again, the question is the owner's business purpose. So if I order pizza and the delivery guy, it's not DiGiorno. It is delivery, and he brings it to my door. Yeah, that's a business relationship. So he's a business visitor. Same thing is true. My washing machine starts to leak and leaking all over the floor, and I call the plumber and I say, I got this leaky water. Can you come over and fix it? Well, he's coming as a business visitor, but at the same time, it's not as though I then have to prepare. I have to go around shutting off all the electricity so that he's a plumber after all. I call him because I don't know how to deal with this. So reasonable care for someone inviting a plumber, or for that matter, inviting the pizza delivery guy, reasonable care would not mean that I'd run out and, you know, sweep off the front stairs and so forth. That's sort of part of their business. But again, technically speaking, they are business visitors because they're pursuant, and this isn't a social call the delivery guy is making, it's a business relationship. Mr. Gallard, or Mr. Both of you, I couldn't tell. Yeah, go ahead. Whichever.
Does the trespassers not hold on to
It's sort of a mixed bag, because again, you can say, I'm not complaining about a condition on your property. At the very end of this chapter, after we think we know what we're talking about, we find out, oops, you know, it turns out there's a more fundamental question, which is this a premises liability case? So if I get bitten by your dog, I would claim, you would claim, if I get bitten by your dog, you would claim, oh, this is a premises liability case. I only have a duty to avoid, you know, whatever. And I would say, no, this is not a premises liability case. This is a dog bite case. And it's sort of like the guy who gets hit in the mouth with a golf club later on. You know, is this, oh, but you're my social guest. Wait till I get my 5-iron out. whereas the plaintiff says this has got nothing to do with premises liability. This is a negligence with a golf club case. So that part of it we got to figure out later on. But assuming it really is about the premises, then we have to apply these categories. Or so the defendant says. We're still working through the plaintiff's argument as to why this stinks. And what again is the plaintiff's argument as to why?
Well, she makes a couple. First, she said that she was an invitee.
Okay.
She was in the classification. Then she kind of has a backup plan that, well, this whole classification isn't right.
And that's the part I want to talk about. What's wrong with it from her perspective? Yeah, the language in Roland that's striking is on page 7, right-hand column, a little bit of, this is still 1968, not yet gender-neutral language here. A man's life or limb does not become less worthy of protection by the law because he's come upon the land of another without permission, with permission, but without a business purpose. So again, the idea that an arm is an arm is an arm, and don't we as a society want people to exert the same level of care to prevent an injury to someone, rather than saying, oh, don't worry about that, they're just a trespasser, they're just a licensee. Go ahead. Now, if this is not merely a trespass, but someone I reasonably fear, and my son was out with some friends the other night, and they were, fortunately he didn't engage in this, but his friends were out, you know, they wanted to go someplace, and late at night they were jumping somebody's fence to go escape from whatever it was, and we're not going there, the sheriff pulled this, one of these got a call, and pulled one of these kids in and, you know, said, hey, someone was out there the other day, you know, and got hit with a baseball bat. Because the owner... Now, the rule, I mean, you may have heard the rule that you're supposed to, you know, if you shoot somebody, make sure you drag them back into the house. sort of cynical idea about that. It reflects the thing about it that reflects genuine legal principle is the idea that when it comes to an intruder in your house, you have the right to use reasonable force to protect your own safety, and if you have a reasonable fear of a threat to your life or serious bodily injury, you can use deadly force. You can shoot. If you have a reasonable fear, and again, if there's somebody in my house at 2 in the morning, and of course, I think this actually happened tragically, I think it was about 10 years ago, it was in Spokane, I think it was out in Deer Park or something. Somebody was pulling like Halloween joke, and they got into the closet and jumped out of the closet at night, and the whoever it was, I think it was one of the kids, and then the dad or something, I forget exactly what it was, reached into the nightstand where all red-blooded Americans keep a loaded firearm, pulled that out and shot this person, who was a friend, to death. Now, it was a 14-year-old daughter. Yeah. So dad shoots 14-year-old daughter, you know, mistakenly. But again, the notion is, in the middle of the night, when somebody's in your space and you don't have time to say, could I please see some ID, you don't know that they're going to shoot you first. If they're brazen enough to be in your house, they may be brazen enough to slit your throat. Again, it's for a jury to decide whether that person is using, has a reasonable basis for using even deadly force. Now, the law is quite clear that if the guy's running away, even though he's got your laptop and all your class notes and everything else that you would kill for, you cannot use deadly force if it's merely property. And many people don't like that rule, but the Supreme Court has said, in effect, deadly force can only be used in defense of life rather than being used in defense of property. So, that's why the sort of cynical expression, if you drag the person into your house, it's easier to make the claim, I had a reasonable basis for using deadly force, than if they're shot in the back, climbing over your fence to try to get away. Anyway, okay, so again, the set of rules with respect to the use of deadly force and trespassers, you'll take up in criminal law as well. But, okay, so we're back at the classification scheme and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. The plaintiff says it's a bad thing because of the sort of creepy kind of inequality that it seems to be reflecting. What does the court say to the plaintiff's argument? Okay.
And then also with delegate social policy issues to the jury,
Okay, so in this context we're not really pushing this line yet, but with respect to this line differentiating these two classifications, the court is saying, let's think for a moment what would happen if we converted licensees into invitees. So when I say mi casa y su casa, but I'm really saying, in effect, I'm held to the same standard as Nordstrom or Safeway, the standard of reasonable care, suddenly that's going to make it I'm going to be less likely to invite you to my house. And as you were saying, the jury would then decide what reasonable people do. Okay, so reasonable people, I guess, hire electricians or, you know, they fix the railing and stuff. I'd rather sit around and, you know, read the newspaper or play with my dog. Other people are out there mowing their lawns and doing stuff. That's fine. But can I live the way I want to live? And if I want to have somebody over to my house, they can choose to accept the invitation or not. So again, you have this kind of clash between the sense, on the one hand, of letting people live their own life unmolested, not having the government tell them how everybody has to live, and on the other hand, the notion that, well, wait a minute, what you're really saying is that we're going to leave certain people unprotected. They're going to be at the mercy of people in social context. So in answer to the plaintiff, the court's answer is, okay. Yeah, there's something hidden about it, but the danger was their cars being driven by drunk high school students, which was a danger of which she undoubtedly was well aware, she herself being a member of that very class. So the court's answer, and again we see from time, you know, the court sort of goes back and forth. Are different courts at different times in different cases say either it's time for us to change this bad rule, or, well, maybe this rule is maybe good, maybe the rule is bad, but gee, we've had it for so long, if it's going to get changed, it ought to be done by the legislature. And this is one of those cases where they say, let the legislature take this up if that be their pleasure. Same basic issue in Roland versus Christian. So it's kind of a goofy little case for other reasons, and we can sort of quickly do it and still have the same discussion about whether it's a good thing. Of course, obviously, the court takes has a different answer to the same question. Can somebody tell us about Roland versus Christian?
Defendant had a broken faucet.
Okay. And apparently it's one of those old, the kind of faucets where there's a hot and a cold, and the, each one has this sort of lever on it. The handle is a, basically a lever, and it's covered with this porcelain, which when you break it is like glass. So it's got this sharp edge to it. When he grabs onto the handle to turn it, it slices his hand and gets a fairly serious injury. Now, so he files suit against her, and what's the defendant's response to that? Okay. Procedurally, what does she do? She files a motion for summary judgment. Yeah. On what basis? Yeah. And what happens? Yes. Summary judgment motion is granted, so he appeals. Now, this is the reason why it's a goofy case. On appeal, let's suppose you did nothing with the status classifications. On what basis should the Supreme Court of California have granted the appeal saying nothing about the status classifications? How do you know it's a hidden peril? But how do we know that he was unaware of this peril?
I guess he wouldn't
voluntarily put his hand in. Yeah. If he grabbed onto it, he would have done so more gingerly. He's not going to slice his hand open if he's aware of the fact that this thing is broken and could injure him. So, I mean, at least you have the inference, and if he says he didn't know, it creates a jury question. It's hard to see how a trial judge could say, oh, well, you know, at least with respect to that, it is a jury question. What about the question whether it was a known peril? Again, a no-brainer. From what you said earlier, she reported to the landlord. So it's not as though, I mean, if anything, if you're going to grant summary judgment to anybody, it would almost seem like you'd grant summary judgment to the plaintiff to say it's a known peril that she didn't warn about and that it was the failure to warn him that resulted in his injury. So for some crazy reason, the trial judge grants a summary judgment motion to her. But the issue on appeal is not the application of these well-known principles, but whether we're going to continue to use the principles at all. And the court's answer on that question is?
No.
Why not? Yeah. Now, and the argument that reasonable people don't vary the level of care depending upon a person's status. Is that true? Does a reasonable person give different levels of care depending upon whether you're a social guest or a business visitor? Well, why not? Certainly the difference between the level of care I use for trespassers and the level of care I use for people that have my permission, if I happen to know that people use the back part of my property as a shortcut to get from one place to another, kids like to go back there and, you know, ride their bikes through that area, or people like to use it as a jogging path, or what have you. I know people are there. I may put up a sign that says, maybe a sign that says private property someplace. They ignore it. Will I rationally use less care for those people and their safety than I would for someone that I've invited to my house for dinner? I would think that's a perfectly rational thing to do. Is it rational for Safeway to use a greater level of care for the people who are their paying customers than someone they allow to use their property, but only in a sort of, bare permission fashion? Yeah. So the premises so to speak, that the court relies upon to reach its conclusion that these status classifications don't make any sense, well, I'm not so sure I agree with the court's premises. There is rationality to expecting different kinds of care depending upon the kind of relationship there is between the visitor and the owners. Cleveland? Could be, but that's, you know, maybe the landlord settled, or it may be there's some other reason why the plaintiff chose to sue this person rather than the landlord. Again, it's kind of an odd little case for this point to be raised. Now, the other sort of strange thing about this case is what happens once we abandon the classification scheme in California. What's the new rule in California? Mr. Jones?
Reasonable care based on that.
Reasonable care under the circumstances, taking into account, the court makes explicit that you can take into account these very things they thought were irrelevant. So let's see, where do they say this? Yeah, top of page 8, left hand column at the top. Yeah. Although the plaintiff's, this is about 5 lines down from the top on page 8 and left, although the plaintiff's status as a trespasser licensee or invitee may, in the light of the facts giving rise to such status, have some bearing on the question of liability, status is not determinative. What the court is essentially saying is we've dropped these as formal categories, but they remain factors for the jury to consider. What we've done is we've made it more difficult for the plaintiff to get summary judgment, but we've allowed the jury to essentially consider these when they decide what a reasonable person would have done. So, to some extent, it's a tempest in a teapot. The court's making a big deal about the fact that it's ridding itself of this, moldy old medieval stuff, but then it's sort of acknowledging, well, you know, I suppose it would be reasonable to consider the plaintiff's status when you're deciding what reasonable care would be. Mr. Bradford.
In the court, or in this case, the court trying to make a compromise between the civil code and the common law, coming up with this formulation, to keep quoting that. Civil code,
we're
just like standard reasonable care, and then
which is doubly ironic. Remember the last time we visited that? Remember in Lee versus Yellow Cab, where the California Supreme Court is looking at the civil code. The defendant is saying, "Here, civil code says that statutes." That's just, you know, they didn't really mean that. It's our job to sort of keep updating the civil code in light of modern reality. So, again, the court is taking this kind of more what I would call a frisky attitude toward feeling that the precedents or the past ways of doing things are not binding. Again, it's hard to tell. I mean, it's hard to see to what purpose this is being done, except to make it harder for defendants to get summary judgment. If you're a trespasser and you get injured in that pool of sulfuric acid, it's no longer a simple question to say, "Oh, they didn't owe a duty." Next case, You have to say, well, sure, this person's a trespasser, but after all, would a reasonable person with a pool of sulfuric acid at least put up a warning about that? Wouldn't cost very much. Yeah, they're trespassers, but gee, it killed them. Again, the common law would say, once you determine their status, the burden on the plaintiff is to establish that there wasn't simply a failure to protect, there was an aggressive, intentional act. In California, that's a question for the jury. What's reasonable? Okay, now, I'm going to assume for purposes of the exam that we are in a jurisdiction governed by, because virtually all the jurisdictions, I mean, California led the way in lots of areas. We'll see later on product liability. Their decision was one of the first that established strict liability. And this, you know, it looked like California was going to lead the way toward the abandonment, but it basically died as a movement. There were a couple of other jurisdictions that went along with this, and then it stopped. So we got 42, 47, whatever it is, jurisdictions that follow the traditional status classification, and then there's California. Now, to be sure, it's whatever it is, 12% of the U.S. population, But again, in terms of the overall legal landscape, it's an anomaly, and most jurisdictions use the classification system. So if you want to throw in a footnote, it says, you know, some don't use this, but again, you can assume for purposes of the exam that the jurisdiction in which your case is situated is one that follows the traditional status classification. Then what we're going to do after we come back from the break is begin to apply these, see how they work, and again, sort of acclimate yourself to the idea, I see a case, I figure out the plaintiff's status, I then determine what duty is owed. So we'll come back in 10 minutes.